I think. Yeah, we're live.
I see live at the top. 11
I
seconds
see
in.
It. Although I see something uploading.
Yeah.
I think that's the intro. I don't want to start speaking and then the intro play. So what?
Theme music.
Love it.
A pile of clothes you never wear anymore. Turn them into.
We got commercials too.
I was going to say, you get commercials too, like this big time.
Come on now. Need a theme song from the Jeffersons. We moving on up.
I don't know if
right?
Shinny is a plane.
She's muted, I think. You know, we're just going to start. So, hi, everyone. Thank you for joining this episode of Pull Up and Pour. I'm sorry that I'm a little bit late here. If there are some technical difficulties, this is our first episode. So, this is our first episode. So, we're just going to kind of jump right into it. And I am going to go ahead and just kind of introduce everyone. My name is Keisha Reynolds. I'm the host of Pull Up and Pour. And I have Eddie Theokis, who is here. She is our resident licensed professional counselor. Okay, and then we have our very special guest. This is Eddie Garcia, lovingly known by his friends and family as Garb. So thank you guys for joining me, and thank you for being a part of Pull Up and Pour.
Absolutely.
Okay, so
thanks for having us.
So yes, yeah, so we're just going to kind of jump right into this, and of course, this is our happy hour. Okay, so feel free to bring whatever beverage you have. You know, just sit here, relax with us, pull up, and most of all, pour out your heart or whatever you have in your glass. Okay, so
love it. Well, Keisha, can you tell people what Pull Up and Pour is about?
Can. So Pull Up and Pour is actually a site that I came up. This is a podcast I came up with of wanting to be able to talk about some of the harder topics, especially as it relates to mental health. Okay. So this is not an attempt to diagnose. So this is not like a mental health where you can call in and get advice in terms of diagnoses and things of that sort. Eddie, our resident therapist, her job is here is just basically to kind of sift through things in terms of explaining maybe certain things and how other modalities may potentially help, but it is not about asking like in terms of a diagnosis or anything like that. So it's not really, it is to educate, okay, about different topics that we are talking about, but it's not to get a diagnosis. But this is something that we're doing, or that I'm doing here, so that we can, you know, kind of sit, have those hard conversations, but feel comfortable in doing it because it's going to be a comfortable space. So think of this as your mental health happy hour, if you will. So that is why Pull Up and Pour is here. That's why I thought of it. And that's a little bit about it. So I'm going to actually ask Eddie to kind of introduce herself as well. I am a faith-based life and relationship coach, okay, where I marry meditation, faith-based meditation based on scripture, and combine that with a coaching a framework. So that is kind of what I do and what I will be bringing, you know, to this, you know. And then, Eddie, I'll let you explain in terms of who you are and what you do.
So my name is Eddie, and I am a therapist. I've been working as a therapist for over 20 years. I started out in community mental health, working in inner cities and working with kids who had navigated the journey of like abuse and neglect, and working with families to sort of like get them whole and functioning. And I did that for about 14 years and then went into private practice. I took a break from therapy for a few years and just came back. Therapy has always been my calling. And I came back after I became a mom to do private practice. And since then, I have been really focused on working primarily with women who have suffered from trauma and abuse. You know, my passion project is, you know, Garp, I know you're here, like you're a dude, but like my passion is working with women and moms specifically, because in my mind, it's like, if you can get a mom healthy, you make society healthy, right? Like without moms, without healthy moms, we cannot have healthy society. So unfortunately, you know, moms, especially minority moms, bear the brunt of like a lot of society's ills. And so I make it my mission to try to work with those, to work with those moms and those women who have navigated trauma and stress and anxiety. And I use predominantly trauma-based modalities like EMDR and sand play and yoga to help regulate moms and get them to their best self. So I've been doing that for the last 6 years now. And so I love it. And so I am like happy to be here and participate and have real conversations with people, because I know, especially in the therapy space, the things that we talk about behind the scenes are like, you know, people don't want to talk about them in public spaces and in their homes and in their families, because it just, there's stigma and there's shame. And I think it is so important to have conversations with people to let them know that they're not alone. The conversations that they're having in my office, it's like everyone is having those conversations, but no one really wants to admit that they're having those conversations and those feelings. And so, you know, to be a part of this format and this forum to invite people to have real conversations, I'm like happy to be a part of. So that's why I'm here. And I provide any insight and ideas that I can to help move the conversation along. So thanks for having me.
Okay, and on to our special guest, Eddie. Go ahead and introduce yourself, and then we'll kind of get into the nitty-gritty.
Okay, no problem. My name is Edward Garcia. My family and friends would know me as Garp. That is the nickname I was given very long ago in the inner city streets of Trenton, where I grew up as. Working corrections for 29 years. I am currently retired. I retired October 1st of 2022. As stated before, these are conversations that you have in your head, but you would like to express them, you know, to other people who are dealing with the same situation. Say, I wouldn't call them problems, but, you know, everybody's situation is different. So I will leave it at that, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
Experience is the best teacher. So we've all been there and done that. So I'm here for it all. Whatever questions that you have, you know, that I can answer to the best of my ability, I'm here, you know.
Okay. Well, Eddie, that is actually a perfect segue into the first question. And that is, you know, what led you into going into correction, to pursue a career in that industry? What drew you to the line of work?
It was actually my mother. But when you graduate, you know, I graduated out of Trenton High and really didn't have any direction of where I was going. She kind of steered me there, was, you know, only because of the pay and the actual benefits that career would provide, not knowing the long-lasting terms or the long-lasting things that you would deal with. That was what she engaged in and stayed on me about. Like, you need to take the test. This is a good job. This is something that you want to have. This is a career, you know, but when you're 19, 20, you don't think about careers then. You know, luckily for me, I had a mother who was grounded enough to say, listen, this is what you should do. I'm taking you to take the test. So it wasn't me per se. I was just a young, you know, young man in the world just trying to make my way. And she was adamant about trying to find me something that would build a career for me and that I could be proud of.
So you didn't have a, like, I want to be this when I grow up. You just kind of like, you just like navigating life. And then like 18, 19 happens. It's like, well, what are you going to do now? Like, what are you going to do?
Yeah. And then I was like, I was like any other child, you know, I think I'm going to make it as a professional athlete. And then you realize that, you know, being 5'9", 175 pounds, football ain't in it for you. You know, as a child growing up, everybody wants to be the doctor or the professional athlete, the things that sound good to everybody. And then you get to be a grown up when you're 18, and then you find out that life isn't as easy as you thought it would be. Yeah. You know, luckily, again, I've had somebody that stayed on me, that was in my corner, that pushed me to the right, you know, right career.
That's great.
Okay. So you're in this career and, you know, you first started the job. Did you have any expectations about working in a prison? You know, what was about the environment? You know, did it, the reality match what you imagined, basically?
Well, first off, when you first start in a career such as corrections, you're scared out of your wits. And if anybody tells you any different, they're lying to you. I'm here to tell you, because it's something you don't expect. It's new.
Right.
You've never been in an environment. You don't know what's going to happen, unless you're mentally insane. You're afraid.
Right.
So it's easy for me to say that when I first walked in. You know, it's a shock to your body. It's a shock to your system. When the gates close behind you, it becomes sort of like surreal, because you realize there's no running after that.
Okay.
No way out. If they want to do something to you, they can't.
Okay. So can I ask, like, in terms of the process, like, once you decided that you wanted to be a corrections, like, you know, you, like, I don't know, do you go to a recruiting office? You sign up at school? Like, how does that process work? Like, you say, okay, I'm going to be a corrections officer. I'm going to work in jails. And you call up, like, how does that work? Like, I, like, genuinely, because again, when I think most people hear corrections officer, it's like, oh, you're gonna go work in a jail? Like, are you crazy? Like, because again, you'd have to be in sick, right? But then it's just like, this is what I'm gonna pursue. I'm gonna pursue a career in law enforcement, specifically corrections. And like, what do you do? Like, you take classes? Like what is the process? Like, walk us through that, because you willingly make a choice to go work with, let's just say, criminals, right? Like that's from a layperson. Yeah. It's like, people have done some things. They're behind bars because they're not angels. And you're actively choosing to go into it. You don't have family history of it. Your dad, great, great grandfather wasn't in it. Like, so you're willingly choosing to go into an environment that you know, criminals are in there. So like, what does that look like? Like walk us through that. I am like curious. Mom, I'm going to go.
It originally starts with you taking the test. You take a test, and the higher you score, right? They take the higher scores out. So you have to, if the lower you score, the longer you have to wait for them to call you. So luckily, I scored high on the test, and then you get a call, and they ask you if you're interested in the job, and they want to know, you know, are you available? You tell them your answer. You say yes. Then that process leads you to see a site. You have to actually see a psych before you go to become a corrections officer. They evaluate you. You go in there for a couple of hours. After that, then the process begins. They start your background. They do all the normal things that a normal job would do. Mm-hmm. They take care of that. And then they call you to the job. That process starts you with now it's changed. But when I started, it was they give you an orientation for 2 weeks.
That's it. 2 weeks.
That's it. Your orientation lasts for 2 weeks. That's it. The first week is all recordings, tape back then, VHS, because I'm a little.
Yeah.
They were VHS tapes. You sit in the classroom, you watch scenarios and you watch incidents happen on tape that naturally you would probably see maybe on TV nowadays, but they run you through like scenarios based on someone making a training tape.
Okay.
For my case, if I can remember correctly, 14 cadets when I started. So we sat around a big table and watched these tapes. Then at the end of that week, then you go into the actual facility.
Huh. And you already knew where you were going to be assigned to? Like, or they say like after your week, then we're going to, depending on how we think you're going to navigate, you're going to go to this prison for corrections for federal. I don't know.
So I was county. I'm county facility. So I was never in a state or a federal facility.
Got it.
So in Trenton, we had two county facilities when I started in 93. We had downtown, we had the detention center, which was downtown Trenton off of Market Street. That housed all the major criminals, which was the maximum criminals. They went downtown. I worked at the workhouse, which was in Lambertville on Route 29. That housed minimum to me.
And you didn't get to choose that. They chose that for you.
No, you can choose, kind of like you have a say. You have they ask you, is it beneficial for you to come here? Do you want to go there? Is it easier for you? But in the end, you really didn't have a choice. It's where they put you.
Okay, got it.
So they put me at the workhouse, and then that leads you to your 1 week of orientation inside the actual facility. So in that next Monday, you show up after all those tapes on the weekend, and then you come in, and Monday morning, you come in. Back then, it was shirt, no tie, just a shirt, button-down shirt, and black or blue pants or jeans.
And that was like your own wardrobe, wasn't it? Like you didn't go to like an outfit, Uniforms R Us or something like that and get them. No. Right.
Now you do.
Yeah,
now
right.
You suited before you come in, but back then it was just personal shirt, button-down, and some pants. Make sure they were dark pants.
Okay. All right. Let me ask you. Okay, so you're there, and I know before you were at the county, and I know at one point we discussed in terms of, at some point it turned into like maximum security. Okay, at that point. So when it makes that shift, and how long had you been there, first of all, before it made that shift into maximum security, and what were the differences that you could say, okay, this is kind of real deal. This is maximum security versus before it was not. What was that shift like?
I started in 93. We merged in 98. They closed downtown due to asbestos, which made them have to merge all the inmates together down at the workhouse.
Okay.
Minimum and maximum all now housed.
All housed together. Right. But you have to realize that our facility wasn't meant to house maximum inmates. Right. So now you're getting all these new answers added to what you were supposed to. Now they're adding gates. Now they're adding locks and security. Wow. Now everything that you're used to, all the format that was, is now null and void, because now you have to learn a whole new way to do it. Mm. I'll give you an example of when I first started in 93, all of our units as housing units went to the cafeteria to eat. That is how they were fed. Mm-hmm. You would call out the unit, or the supervisor would call out the unit. You'd open the gate to the unit. The unit would go eat. The unit would come back. If the unit didn't come back, or somebody from the unit didn't come back, you would just have to call and find them. That's how lax. Well, I wouldn't say lax. I was just the way.
Yeah, it's minimum security, right.
They weren't really worried about you leaving or doing anything. Once the shift happened, and once we had the maximum inmates, now they took care of that. There was no more going to the actual cafeteria. Now they were fed on the actual unit.
Wow.
So that in itself is a big change, because now you have to feed inmates. Mm. Now you have to worry about inmates getting over, trying to get an extra tray. That wasn't your worry before. So that's just added extra stuff going on. That's just the little things.
Yeah.
The bigger things you could probably imagine, as you've seen in movies.
Yeah.
It's a different, an entirely different type of inmate compared to what we were used to. Not just the officers in my area, the ones that were coming from the detention center were a whole different breed, because they weren't used to the medium security. They were saying, well, wait a minute, how do you inmate, how do you house inmates? Like, this isn't supposed to be like this.
Right.
They were more security minded than we were. But we were like, wait a minute, this is how we operated. Right. This is what we're used to. And they were like, no, this isn't supposed to be, we can't have this way because this will never work. You know, they'll go down the line security base and say, no, this, we have to change this. So that is why a lot of the changes and or, you know, the things that we were used to had to change due to the fact that the security of the inmates was different. Now, as far as the inmates themselves.
Yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit? Like, yeah, like the minimum security inmate versus the, like what? I live in the space of energy and personality and what are the characteristics
and how did that affect you? How did that affect you in terms of dealing with them? Because obviously you had to deal with each person.
The types, yeah, different types.
So what is that like?
Yes. It's a shock because you're not used to dealing with those type of inmates. But gradually you learn. I wouldn't say you learn, but you
adapt.
You the fact that they're a different inmate living in a space where originally it was meant for medium security. So now they're trying to get over because that housing unit isn't supposed to be housing maximum inmates. So for instance, when they first moved, my partner and I, Perry Brown, we always had to deal with inmates stealing inmates' commissary. I never had to deal with, and that's just something small. That's just on the smaller scale. Something I never had to deal with.
Yeah.
But the inmates would go out for a wreck. The minute they would get their commissary, would be gone when they came back.
That's just
tiny. And I'm on a unit with, originally was housed for 100 inmates. We were on D-Pod. They triple bunked every unit.
Wow.
In Mercer County Correction Center.
Oh my goodness.
Which made all the units skyrocket for inmates. Now, you have to understand that every unit was only supposed to house what it was originally supposed to house.
Y'all didn't get any bigger. The facility that they didn't build the wing.
There's only enough showers.
Oh, yeah.
There's only enough. That never changed. The inmates did. They went from 100 to 139, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. But there was only 6 toilets. There were only 10 showers. That didn't change. So you have to understand that the frustration of the inmate changes.
Right.
So they're used to getting it a certain way or doing things a certain way. So let's just say if I was an inmate, I'm used to being a minimum security inmate. I'm walking to chow. Now I'm getting chow served on a unit. Now I don't get to walk around. Because you have to remember, I'm still a medium inmate. But I'm housed with maximum in.
Right. Well, and is the minimum, I'm just a layperson, right? But is the minimum security inmate, like that's a person who, let's just say, or the workhouse, like they're about to go home in like 3 months or 6 months. Like they're on the way home, let's just say, back into society versus a maximum security inmate might be there for life or years or like you're looking at 40, 50 years. And so you're going to die in this facility versus someone who's like, I'm out of here in like 6 months. So the energy is different. Like I have nothing to lose. Like I'm here for 50 years versus I have everything to lose. I'm here for 5 months. I'm about to go home I'm not sure I'm going to make it out because I'm in with maximum security.
Your circumstances are totally different. Right? Your circumstances change from his to hers. So we never housed inmates that had 20 years, but we did house them for, let's just say, if I was sentenced to 20 years, but I hadn't gone to court yet to get my sentence, we housed them up until that point.
Wow.
But once they get sentenced to the 20 to 25, 40, 60 years, then we house them maybe for another 6 months to a year. Then they go to the state facility where they will do their rest.
Okay.
But at that point, they know they've been convicted and they're going, going for 40
they know years. Their charges. So they know they have the possibility of not seeing anyone else, not going home, not seeing their family. And then here you are with 6 months and you're like, what?
Right. And I'm walking around going to the shower and now I have to like wait my turn with, you know.
Because naturally he's not going to let you go.
Right.
Yeah. Or she, because we have females that you have to deal with that.
Male and female prisoners.
Yes.
Wow. And did this increase in terms of officers, or were they still keeping the same amount of officers when this surge of inmates took place? Did they bring on more staff, or did that not happen?
So originally, when the merge happened in 98, we had the officers, of course, from the detention center and non officers. But we didn't have enough spaces or enough jobs for everyone. So what they did was they offered the people that wanted to go, they could go to the state because the state needed officers. So they would transfer, take all their time and go to the state. So you lost some officers that was working with us and was working with downtown. They took the rest of us and merged us together.
I see.
But how does that work, like with your cohort, like with coworkers, like personalities and like really, like, do you guys, I don't say stick together, or is there even like drama amongst the officers? Like walk us through that. Cause it's, again, it's a stressful job, and I don't say you versus them,
right?
But you're here to do a job versus someone who is like, you know, has like lost their freedom. Right. But even within your coworkers or your peers, what's that like? Can you talk about that? Like the energy or like the support?
Your partner, right? They're like your partner, right?
And well, you have, if you're on a living unit, you would have a partner per se, depending on the days of the week that you work.
Okay.
Or if you were different, like let's just say, for instance, you were a relief officer, then you just relieved units. So yours would change day to day. I was more of a unit officer, so when we merged, I had Perry Brown. Luckily, we kind of knew each other beforehand, so we had like a sort of a rapport before that. So it wasn't like a big like issue between him and I. Mm-hmm. But again, even then, even though we knew each other, the jails were different. Everything was ran different. So you had his side, and then you had my side, and we were trying to merge that, trying to find the best way where we could get our job done to the best of our ability without, you know, disrupting, let's just say, his security purposes. And then I would say like, now, well, this is how it's done over here. So it was an adjustment, but luckily I had somebody that I already knew. Now, I don't know, I can't speak for everybody.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's instances where people didn't get along with who they worked with. I mean, later on down the line, that was some of the cases, but not for the first initial transfer of officers and inmates. I lucked out and had Perry, so it was pretty easy for me, pretty cool, and we got along, you know, just fine. As a matter of fact, he is now the goddaughter of my youngest.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
So I have a question for you. You know, I've heard of, and perhaps you can explain this a little bit, about situational awareness. Many times you also hear in terms of with training for martial arts as well, situational awareness. Okay. So that seems very critical in a job like this, knowing your situational awareness. Did you find that that mindset also followed you outside of work as well?
Absolutely. 100%. I'll give you everyone from law enforcement knows this. If we go out to eat at a restaurant,
you look at you're sitting where you can see the door.
I never sit with my back to the door. Never. Anybody in law enforcement never sits with their back. It happens. I would tell my kids or my wife, we got to switch just so you can see things
that are going on.
Right. Yeah. It's just the little nuances or the little things that you notice that regular folks don't notice.
Right.
So my daughters, my youngest, who is now in college, I tell her, when you go to the store, just be careful of where you park your car. Make sure you try and park it under a light so that it's lit. If you're parked next to someone, pay attention to when you're walking up. Get off your phone. You don't need to be on your phone at that point in time. Those are just little things that you pick up along the way. And you pick up people's body language in facility. You kind of know, like, if this person is joking around every day and today he's not joking around, something's wrong.
Something's off.
Like there's something. Okay. Yeah. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but
yeah, you just know patterns, you know, and
whether they got a bad situation at home, whether they got sentences that didn't go their way. So you want to try and mitigate that there, then and there. So you would go up and say, like, you okay? Like, everything all right? That's just me. That's how I did it.
Yeah.
Just so I could say, like, I tried.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't say that I wasn't the one to ask you the question. Because if you come on as a living unit officer and the situational where you immediately see, like, some people over here and some people over there, and you're like, well, wait a minute, what happened? And you ask the officer, and you're like, well, I don't know.
Like, well, I don't want to know. I'm just here to do
I can be walking into a hostile environment and not even know.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so it's good to have people on the inside. When I say that, I mean, like, inmates that are you have a fond or a relationship with, that'll tell you, like, listen here, you know, such and such and was arguing today. And
I'm glad you said that. That's one of the things I wanted to find out.
I'm curious about that. Yeah.
That network, because again, in this, I mean, because everything in life is about relationships, right? Okay. So it's being the enforcer. Okay. But, you know, because your job is to keep order. Okay. But also walking that fine line of, okay, at the end of the day, you did what you did, but you are a man, and I'm still respect you for that. And in that environment, respect is a big deal. Okay. Respect is huge. Okay. People will get in arguments and disagreements off of a little and nothing because they felt disrespected. Okay. And because at the end of the day, it's nowhere like on the outside world, you can say, you know, forgiveness, turn the other,
let it go.
And then, you know, but in there you are housed together. So that's very difficult to do. And I think sometimes doing that may to others signal weakness, which is something that you, I'm sure, cannot come across as looking as weak. And if so, that's kind of like your ASS, okay, to a certain extent, okay? So when you think about that as a person who was in there, did you find that you had to kind of put a chip on your shoulders to a certain extent to kind of get through that day or get through this, you know? Obviously, the way you are at home is not the way you are at this when you used to work there. So did you find there was kind of almost like when you stepped there, in my mind, I have to put the armor on, okay? Like, I got to almost, like, put the hoodie on. Like, you know what I mean? Like, maybe not actually.
But the armor,
you have to put that armor on, like, okay, and when you're putting on this armor and protection, what else did you lean on to get you through this? Did you lean on faith? Did you lean on yourself? Like, what also helped you, do you feel, protect you in this environment?
So the worst thing that I could say any officer within any confines of any facility should have is complacency.
Okay.
When you originally or when you initially start off your career, because it's new to you, you are aware of all your surroundings. And see a lot of things that you may not have seen before. The older you get, the more complacent. And unfortunately, we all do it. The more complacent you become, which then entails, like, all right, I didn't see the guys arguing, or I didn't notice what they were doing over there. Because now I've come complacent. I've gotten to know Keisha. I've gotten to know Eddie. You guys are all right. You're cool with me. So I'll just lay back and try to, you know, make my time the way it was. Not at any given time, anything can pop off. And you have to understand, you have to have the mindset that you are only you. That's it. The help will come. But for the time being, in any situation, any given time, you are by yourself on a unit with at least 40-something, 50-something inmates.
Wow.
So you have to have that awareness every single day. You have to tell yourself before you step in there, listen, you have to give yourself a pep talk to say, like, I'm going home today. Somehow I'm going to make it home. And that in of itself is kind of mentally stressful, but you become so accustomed to doing it on a daily basis that you totally forget about it. You don't realize the emphasis you put on your life, on the ability to lose your life at any given time, if they wanted to.
Sure.
When you think about it, totally, you sit down and you say, at any given, I've got to walk into a unit by myself at night with 139 inmates and take a count. If they wanted to grab me at any given time, they could. What are you going to do?
Sure. And what were your hours like? Like, were you, was it like 9 to 9 and like 4 days a week? Like, typically, like, how many hours a week were you working?
Unfortunately, for the past 15 to 20 years of my career, we were shorthanded, very, very shorthanded officers. So my hours were 11 to 7, 7 to 3, 5 days a week.
Wow.
Oh my God.
11 to 7 and 7 to 3. Five days a week.
16 hours a day, 5 days a week. Ooh. You can ask anyone at the workhouse right now. That is their shift. If you come into work, you are staying for 16 hours for that day. Doesn't matter.
And then, and so, because again, I'm like, I live in the space of, so now you've done work this shift, and now it's like, you got to go to Johnny's basketball game? I've been hypervigilant for all this time. And I think I was asking, because it's like, so like everybody else, like when we get to Friday, we're like, woo, but most of us get to Friday, not in these hyper stressful jobs, and certainly not working, you know, all of the 16 hours. So it's like, How do you shed that, right? Because most of us could say, oh, it's 9 to 5, like I'm done, and then I get the weekend, right? But for you, it's not even like you had 4 days of working and then 3 days to try to decompress and get yourself back and, you know, and go to Johnny's soccer games. It's like that. Now you're gonna miss school drop off pick up days. And so, like, walk us through that, like the toll of that, right? Because it's normalized, right?
Oh, absolutely, right.
Yes. And like, it just is what it is. But I guess for your family, it's the, like, and I don't want to compare it to like an athlete, right? But it's like, you just know what you're marrying into. Like, you just know that, like, dad's, and I don't want to compare you to the athlete, but it's like, you know, dad's going to be on the road for 16. It's only a season of 17 weeks unless he gets to the play. But you, daddy, don't stress daddy out, because he's got to go to work and he's got to go to practice, you know, and all this stuff. But like, does your family, how do you prepare your family for that lifestyle?
To be blunt, you don't.
You don't.
It has to be an experience that they experience to know what it is. So my schedule, again, was 11 to 7, 7 to 3. My daughter, if anybody knows, she played soccer at PDA, which was in Somerset. That's an hour away. So when I come home at 3, her practice is at 5. I have to drive the hour to work, to practice. Let her practice for her hour and a half.
That's a lot.
Take the drive home. Then leaves me about an hour to sleep.
Oh, right, and do homework, and get, and yes, yeah, sleep.
Dinner, I got to shower, then I got to go to sleep, and then get up and do it all over again. That's on a practice schedule. That was a Tuesday, Thursday. Mm. Let's forget about Friday for now. On a Monday and Wednesday, I would come home. It takes me 40 minutes to come home with traffic. So after I come home now, I can't just go to sleep, because I have to work out. If I don't work out, I don't want anybody taking advantage of me. God forbid something happens. So I need to stay on point where I'm able and physical enough to take care of myself. So yeah. I come home, I get home at 4:30, I put my gym clothes on, I go to the gym till 6:30.
Sorry, 6:30, everyone.
I come home,
like,
I eat my dinner at 7, 7, I go
here
to sleep. 9:30, I'm back
kind of
up
buffering,
getting ready to go.
And it's trying to reconnect.
So that was my weekly schedule. Friday comes.
Just bear.
Friday, I get to relax.
Bear with me.
Friday,
for
I come
a little
home.
Bit.
I come home Friday. We eat dinner at a normal regular time, 6:30, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. I'm on the couch. I'm falling asleep. But that brings a whole nother problem, because now my wife has not gotten any time, and now she's wondering why you're asleep at 8 o'clock, 8:30.
Right.
Well, wait a minute. What's going on? So now you have to try and juggle that, balance that out.
Yeah.
And now I'm even tired now. So now I'm down to one day, Saturday.
Yeah, so that's right.
You got housework to do. You got chores to run, right? So now Saturday is gone after you're doing all that catching up on everything that you missed during the week. After that comes Sunday. Sunday I get up. I have to prepare for Sunday night because I'm going to work at 11 to 7.
Wow.
So it was like a process that never ended. Unfortunately, with the time schedule. So the only time you really get is your time off. Mm. So if you call out, you know, or if you take your vacation time.
Yeah.
But my thing with that is you're allotted a certain amount of time during in the beginning of the year.
Yeah, like how many days, like how many vacation sick days, like how many?
All depending on how long you were there for, but you got 12 sick days. You got 3 personal days in vacation time, depending on how long you were there for. So when I left, I don't want to say it was 4 weeks of vacation time.
Mm. But after 20 plus years, I don't say you only got 4 weeks, but you only were able to earn 4 weeks working 11 to 7, 7 to 3 like that. Like it didn't even double up for you. Like it was just.
Right. And that's what I mean. Like all the stuff that they had prepared for us for your time off was based, in my opinion, was based on an 8-hour shift.
Correct. Correct.
So in my opinion, all of that should have been doubled. Everything
correct.
Should have.
Correct.
If I lived in that way, it should have been doubled, but it wasn't that way. And the minute you crossed that line to use up what you had, they were writing you up, they were suspending you. So now you're trying to make up from the monies that you lost.
Yeah.
You use all your sick time. God forbid if you're sick, your kids get sick.
Correct. Correct.
You know, once that is gone, that's it. There is no coming back. So you get write-ups. 3 write-ups get you suspension days. And the more you miss, the more you get written up, the longer the suspension days. And once you get to a certain amount of steps in your suspensions, then they can terminate you if they want to.
Wow. 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 Well, did you find that some people got to the burnout point where they're like, screw it, like write me up, fire me, like, cause like, so be it, like, fine. Like, I can't do it anymore. Like, fine. Like, you know what I'm dealing with. Like, I'm stressed out. I'm burnt out. Like I can't.
The only thing I would say was really good about it, workhouse, is like it's union, so
yeah,
do anything to you, like off the skin. So what would happen, in my experience, is I didn't get it, but a lot of the officers would file for FMLA, which is family leave. They would get that now, depending on what your child or what your elders or what your parents were dealing with, they give you a number of days. Now you didn't get paid for them days.
Yeah.
Time off. So you were able to enjoy that day. Mm. You could clearly make up the money. The money wasn't the problem because you were working overtime the next 2 or 3 days.
Sure.
But you had that availability to take off and re-energize or refocus yourself. As whereas someone like me, I didn't have that. I was going to say,
so how did you navigate? Like, what's the mindset for you that like allowed you to sustain yourself for like over 20 years? Like, how did you sustain your mindset wise? Like you said, you work out, you exercise, you kind of take care of yourself. But how do you mentally, how do you mentally work in a way that you're like, I'm missing time on my family, I'm making these sacrifices, I'm doing this high stress job? What was your mindset?
Mine was, specifically for me, was that I was able to afford my family and my children the things that I was not. My family could go and come as they please. My wife could get what she wanted. It didn't matter. That was, unfortunately, that became the focus for me, because in the long run, that's what made it all okay.
Yeah. You
know, it's not until now when you realize mentally what you were going through and what you were putting your body through wasn't good at all. It wasn't worth the money. Like, I've seen so many officers and had so many officers of my peers pass away. Some inside the jail. Some died inside the jail.
And until
you get to this point, you don't realize the stress, the anxiety, and all that it entails just to work it. Because in the moment, I didn't think of it. It was just a routine.
It was routine, and your cortisol, adrenaline is keeping you focused, keeping you alive, keeping you, like, you don't know. It's like, we're just in survival.
You sneak in what you can for sleep as opposed to, you know, when or where you're not supposed to do it, but you try and beat the system as best as you can at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't realize the toll it takes long term because you're so focused on something else. And that, for me, was just, you know, trying to provide my kids what I was never afforded when I was a child.
Hey, Hugh, I just want to find, are you guys able to hear me okay?
Yeah.
Her tail off.
Okay, all right. I'm just checking.
It's just, you know, it's just different times.
It kind of went out for me, and I had to kind of go and try to come back in. I just wanted to make sure, you know how technology can be. Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt. Finish what you finished.
I know, I know. We get it. No, this was.
Oh no, it's a big adjustment, and my wife and I have had discussions. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now that I'm retired, and she would say to me, now I'm working again now, but it's in a totally different atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Nothing compared to what I work. And she would come, I would come home from work, and she would say, why the hell are you smiling? Because she's working all day and she's upset. And I would tell her, because this ain't work what I'm doing. To me, I can do this all day. There's no stress on when I have to be to work. There's no stress on when I'm taking my break. There's no stress on when I got to be back from my break. Okay. I don't have to look over my shoulder. So many things are easy to me. This job is just driving around old folks, taking them to Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, and she's wondering why, you know, and I just tell her like, I never realized the anxiety I would have on a Sunday.
Mm.
Getting, and I would wake up, let's just say Sunday at 1 o'clock, the anxiety I would have from 1 to 9, because I knew I had to work.
Like the Sunday scaries, right? Like you talk about Sunday scaries on steroids, it sounds like, for you. Like it was just,
It was just insane. And I didn't realize it until now. It's all over with. And I'm like, man, I can exhale. I can actually breathe.
And so when did you decide like it's time like to retire? Is it just you just would put it, you're like, I'm going to put in my 20 plus years, like, so I can get my pension. Like when did you start to entertain the idea that I wanted to find out from you, I think it's time for me to be done.
Originally,
what were some of the signs that got to you that made you feel like this is it? Like, I can't do this another moment. Like, I'm just going to break if I stay here any longer.
I can answer both questions in one. The minute you see the shift start to happen. So you see the shift in inmates. And what I mean by that is when the gangs took over, you see the shift in inmate.
Ah.
Now you go from another shift in inmates from gangs to now the inmates become younger.
And the inmates
become younger. They become more irate. They become more belligerent. They become it's just a totally different atmosphere. But I never had to really deal with it because I had so much seniority, I wasn't faced to deal with it on a day to day basis on a unit anymore. But you would respond to codes, and the way I was used to it, I'm saying to myself, this isn't right. Like, we're not supposed to be doing stuff like this. So for example, when I first started in 93. If you had an officer on an inmate fight, unfortunately, that inmate was going to pay for that some way, somehow.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the repercussions.
It was just the repercussions
that you dealt with.
Yeah.
If, God forbid, if you put your hands on a female officer, you were going to the hospital. There were no questions asked. There were times, now granted, I will say that some may have sealed their fate when you talk to inmates a certain way. You have to have a level of respect.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they respect you or not, you never know what the inmate is dealing with. So you have to have there were many times that inmates would put their hands on female officers.
Mm.
And because we were never equipped to house inmates of that level, there was nowhere for them to go. So they'd be on the unit 2 or 3 days later.
Wow.
As opposed to a hospital. When I was used to, like, when I first started, there was no way.
You didn't cross the line.
Yeah, I'm seeing the shift, and I'm like, wait a minute, this is right. But I never had to deal with it personally. I'm like, okay, well, if it doesn't deal with me, I ain't got to worry.
Mm-hmm.
So story was, I was relieving an officer on a 1-to-1, which is me sitting down in front of an inmate's door. An inmate wanted to see a supervisor. And I'm like, well, when the supervisor comes around, I'm not calling the supervisor just because you want him. Long story short, he got upset, got irate, threw some liquid through the door that got on me. Now, I'm going to assume that liquid was urine or some mix of such. And where I'm from, where I come up, But we handled that business right then and there. Mm-hmm. So I called my supervisor. I told my supervisor, I said, no, open the door. Call the code, and I'm going to go in. And he was like, well, guard, no, I don't. We don't want to go in there with that. I said, well, wait a minute, Sarge. You don't even have to be here. Matter of fact, go back out the unit. I'm going to call the code. Went, no, I can't let you do that. I don't want you to lose your job. Well, I'm like, sorry.
Yeah, there's a line that's been crossed
right now, because when he threw it on me, I was on a higher tier, so the lower
right.
tier was out
with
watching TV. So they all seen it. So now,
yeah,
there's a respect thing that I have to engage now, because if you throw it on me and they feel that I'm
yeah,
not,
that's right, that, that's okay. Anymore. It becomes okay to do it. Yeah.
No, we're not going to deal with that. So me and him got into it. Eventually, he didn't let me go in, so it got handled. Later on. That's for another story. But that was the initial thing that set me off. And I'm like, wait a minute, let me start to take a longer look at stuff. Because if it comes to me losing my pension,
because
somebody's throwing stuff on me.
After 20 plus years of this and that and waking up and sacrificing that, and this one incident is going to be the thing that.
Now, don't get me wrong. There have been instances where stuff has been thrown and all, and I can understand it, because that's in the daily activities of a jail. If there's a riot, no stuff's going to be thrown. If there's a fight, that's fine. Like you get something on me or somebody spitting at somebody, it happens to get on you.
Right.
If somebody's spitting on you or throwing something at you, personally, me, you and I have a problem.
Correct.
But that was the initial thing that set me to say, let me take a longer look at where I'm at in my career and do I really want to do this?
Mm.
And again, it goes back to family. Like, am I going to risk all of this that I've done for so long to throw it away for somebody that's going to be throwing urine or feces or, you know? And I'm like, you know what? Let me get ready to start the paperwork, because I don't think I can do this anymore.
Wow!
It wasn't worth it in the end. Like the money.
So
was,
how long was that? Was it like within a year? Was it like 3 months?
I would say about a good three to four years.
Okay.
Wow. I was hesitant. I didn't want to, because again, I'm young. When I retired, I was 52. I'm still young. I've got a lot.
You had a lot, it's like you could have stayed long.
Yeah, if I want to, you can go into 62, so I could have won another 10 years in corrections.
Wow. Because
they push you out at 62.
But would you have wanted to stay till 62? Is it that you got so used to it that, I mean, even though it was high stress, it's like, but it was used to it, but like in your mind, did you see yourself staying till 62?
I see myself staying at least. I wanted to stay until at least my little one got out of college. Like that was the original plan.
That was the goal.
To say like, all right, now, because she'll be a senior next year at Alabama, so this would have been possibly my last year ready to go, and I can just take that and roll with it. I don't have to worry about anything. But it was unfortunately time to go. And the fact that all of the officers that were with me as peers were starting to leave. Everybody that I knew was starting to leave. And I mentioned this to Isha before. When I retired, I was number 3 in seniority. But there was, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, just one supervisor that was over me in seniority.
Wow.
So all of my supervisors, every last one of them, were below me in seniority, which would mean I was at the jail way before.
Yeah,
and now
you're seeing the shift. Is like the supervisors, the ones that really had your back, the ones that you went through the fire with, are now gone.
Are gone.
Right. You don't have the same rapport with them. I mean, we were all, for the most part, me and my supervisors were all cool, but you just don't have that.
When you're in
personal
situation,
you didn't go through
what the inmates or do you not know, and do you prefer to know, or do you prefer not to know? And when you do know, if you know, how does that affect the way that you see them?
Right.
Okay.
As a unit officer, I never wanted to know. Because you're on that unit on a daily basis with those same people day to day for 16 hours a day sometimes. Sometimes you would switch. But I never wanted to know. So it was not important for me to know what you were there for, as long as you and I had respect for one another. Now, within my 29 years, my job's changed. There was a point in time where I was working in RD, which is receiving and discharge. So when you receive an inmate, you know exactly what they're here for. You can read it. You actually have to read it because then you have to input it into a computer. So now you're like, really? 13 years old? What are you doing? Like, so now I'm looking at people differently.
I'm
because I'm as a father, regardless of if you have a son or a daughter, when it's dealing with other people's children,
you
want to put something up. You want to listen. Get away from me. I don't want anything to do with you, because there's no telling what could happen.
You know how to
in that aspect, and so. On one point, it's good to know because you know who that person is, so you stay away from it. But then, right. But then as a unit officer, you have to deal with that person on a day-to-day basis. Mm. You don't really want to know. You just want to know that they respect you for who you are and what you deal with and what you stand for on a day-to-day basis. You know. And I will actually say I've had some of my best inmates, and we have what are called runners, people that actually work for you, serve lunch, and do little chores on a unit cleanup. Some of my best runners were ones who were there for, like,
I want to really stick that. I have a question about that.
But I never knew until they left.
Did you come in contact until they left? And I don't know, perhaps you did. Did you come in contact in that space with someone who we would coin the term a psychopath? Clinically, it's, you know, antisocial personality disorder. Okay. But did you come into contact with anybody that was an actual psychopath, you know, or someone who had done like a serial, you know, serial or murders or things of that sort? No, nothing, just complete. No. Yeah.
Like, had no remorse, no sense of, like, you know, morality. I don't say morality, but like, no sense of, like, you know, no regrets, no.
I will say, unfortunately, at this time, at this day and age, the younger generation does not value life at all. If I can label that as a psychopath, because they will.
Yeah.
They will murder somebody, shoot somebody.
Yeah.
The next day be on the unit laughing and joking.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, wait a minute. Dude, you're looking at 20, 30, 40 years, and you're playing cards. And I understand you have to make a life out of it, but shouldn't you be like law books or something trying to fight your case as opposed to, but it.
Just like resigning yourself to.
And it wasn't just like one or two, it was the entire that age group, that mindset that they have. And I would ask them, and I would what are you guys doing? So they tell you, I don't give a F about none of that, G.
So yeah, I find that like with younger people.
Yeah, to answer your question, it's and I hate to say it, but it's their mindset growing up and where they're coming from.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what they've dealt with in their, you know, brief. Correct. Life. I will say that I was on the maximum unit for 13 years as a unit officer. And I will say that I have had some that have come in at a young age. So I would say early 20s that have done unspeakable acts, murdering, shooting, killing people. And I would always say the same thing, like, this ain't time to play. Like, you guys need to, and it'd just be like a play fiend. They'd just do whatever they wanted to do. Years later, they would come back. Mm. Like, if you were from the state and you had to be housed overnight for court in Mercer County, then they would house you overnight. So then I would see them again. I would walk by. I'm like, oh, wait, what you doing here? And they was like, well, gee, I'm down for court. And I would say, well, wait, you quiet now. Like, what's going on? And they would say, different mindset, gee, I don't, that ain't what I'm thinking about anymore. Wow. So there is actual growth within But they have to. You have to get the original or the.
Do they have,
you know, the beginnings of that lifestyle? I guess they grow up within the system.
Do they have any programs? Because that's also means that, you know, we hear that people go to prison. Did you find that there were any programs to rehabilitate people? Okay, to keep them from becoming reoffenders. Okay, like the gentleman that you said. Okay, you know, just on a different mindset, but did they just grow up in there, or were they around a certain group of people that, you know, kind of embraced them, okay, that changed their mindset? I mean, or, yeah, were the programs that were in there that involved them?
Mentored them, maybe, like,
and is that available? Yeah. I mean, I don't know if they had taken that out.
I mean, like, yeah, like don't make the mistakes I made. Like, go get your books, go study, go do something, go learn something.
What did you find that worked that didn't? Did you find that people were actually rehabilitated, or did you find that when they go there, really all they do is get a second kind of education? It's like you go in one way, you come out and more skilled in manipulation because you've been, you know, having dialogue with other inmates, and they're teaching you how to, I don't know, hide a skiv without, you know, a shiv without being, you know, detected. Or they're teaching you ways of, I don't know, how to hotwire a car, you know, more, you know, efficiently. What, you know, like, what was that like?
Yeah.
There is, like, they have programs for everything, just about. So they have, like, law libraries. They have the programs where you can go to school. They have all the programs available to them, but you have to understand that they are now in a maximum unit, so they don't move. They don't go anywhere. So the ability to move, they take that as, I just want to get out of the unit, not to take advantage of the actual. You know, I want to get off of this unit. I'm tired of seeing your two faces all day. Let me get out of here. And they don't take advantage of it. They go up there to bullshit around and play and joke, unfortunately. Now, you do have some that take advantage of it, but you know those. You see the huge books of law. You see the paperwork that they have. But usually that's just someone going to say, all right, well, let me go see Garcia because he got all the law work. He could tell me exactly what I need to know about this law or this case file or that. It's not like they would go to actually take care of their cases until it was time for them to go to court. Now they want to become jailhouse lawyers is what the term is, what we use.
Yeah.
You want to go try and, you know, cram and to understand everything that you can about your case. But unfortunately, in that surrounding, in the county, those programs weren't looked at as something that was beneficial to them. It was just to me
yeah,
it was
time to
play around, get off the unit and laugh and joke and see some of the other inmates that are on some of the other units that you don't normally typically see.
That's unfortunate because that's, you know,
it's there for a purpose, but you don't take that purpose to benefit yourself until it's time that you think it's beneficial to you. And unfortunately, by that time, you've already lost.
Yeah, I have one other question.
You should know this going in, where you can, you know, try and benefit and help your case. But
so I guess my question too is a little bit like, so now obviously it's like maybe towards the end, but how do you like parent your kids now, right? Because you're like seeing these young kids and you're just, and again, no, maybe don't know their story, but you're like, how do I ensure that this is not my kid? Like, do you parent differently? Do you talk about like these, like, how do you parent, like, knowing, again, maybe not knowing their story, but like, man, you just made one or two wrong turns and like now you're here. Like, how do I try to ensure that my kids don't hang out with knuckleheads or don't do that or don't make these proper, like, how do you parent knowing what you know, right? Seeing what you see.
Very, very strictly. Yeah. And I say that to say, like, there are a lot of times you know what can go wrong as an adult. Now you know what can go wrong and the consequences behind that once you hear that. So I tell her, like, a moment of fun can lead you to a lifetime of misery if you're not careful. So my biggest thing was like when my daughters were in high school, like, you want to watch who you hang with. It's hurtful to say because everybody doesn't have your best interests at heart.
Of course.
So you want to be careful of who you're around. Unfortunately, the only teacher of that is experience. You have to let them go through a little bit of things,
of course,
just so they understand.
You're being dad, you're being all thing. You don't know my friend. Like, they're not like that. You've been working too hard in that job, blah, blah, blah.
That's back in the day. You don't know what you're talking about.
You don't know what you're talking about, right? Like, come on, man. Like, yeah, you get that.
I tell them, and then, you know, when stuff happens, they come to me and they say, oh, you know, you're right. But on a different aspect, I would also teach them, like, okay, God forbid you get into a situation where you have to deal with the police or something. So I would show them on TV where people would get pulled over by the police and they start asking questions.
Okay.
And I would tell my daughters,
so
you don't have to answer anything. Don't answer anything. Wow. You're going to jail anyway.
Yeah.
Just be quiet. Yeah, they're just fishing for stuff, for information for you to tell them. You're making their job easier. God forbid. Right? Yeah, just be quiet. You're going to jail anyway. Just hush down. It's better that you be quiet than you just start rapping. Yeah, I'm just because I see it too many times. I've seen so many young kids just doing the dumbest things or just saying the dumbest things. And like I said, I was in R&D, and then the things they say, they write down right on the paper.
They write it down, right? Or make it up or whatever the thing is, right? But it's just like you said it like that, but the context is like not right. Yeah. You said something. So,
right. Such and such said he was driving while intoxicated.
Right.
You just make yourself easier. So you parent differently because you want to protect your children, as any adult or as any parent would. But you know the consequences of said actions when you see it firsthand, when everybody comes in for, you know. And like I said, a minute of fun can lead to a lifetime of misery if you're not careful. And I said this to both of my daughters before they went to college. The only thing I can give you that has any merit is my last name. If you F that up, I've got nothing else for you.
Right. Well, and again, I think about it from the perspective of I grew up with like the Scared Straight, like it was the MTV Scared Straight. Uh-huh. And it was like, it was one of those things where like I had to see it, right? To be like, is that real? Like, is that real? Like, because you didn't believe that, like, that's actually what it was. But that was enough to scare me. That it was just like, I see it on TV and I get freaked out. So in my head, I'm like, did you have, like, bring your kids to work then and be like, look, like, I'm going to bring you to work because this is real. Like, and the stuff I talk about and you yap and dad, it's like, let me bring you to the actual job so that my words don't mean anything.
And
you just need to see what I'm doing.
And worked at actually a junior one. And so saw a lot. So it was just like, you know, I kind of grew up in a sense of, all right, I think I was more afraid of my mother than I probably was. Because I frankly thought my mom was crazy anyway. So, you know, it was because of, she was, pretty strict. And for the most part, I mean, I was no saint, but in terms of the kids go, I was a pretty decent kid. I didn't get into a whole lot of trouble, I'm not saying I was an angel, I think I may have skipped school maybe twice in my lifetime. I didn't get in too much trouble because I was very fearful of my mom. Now that also had its own other, consequences. Okay. But more often than not, it did shape me, I think, to be, have a moral compass.
Right.
And there were just things that I was not going to, there was a limit I wasn't going to go over. And I was in a household raised by, my maternal grandparents, and I had two very strong women, okay? So I had my mom in front and my grandmother in back, okay? And my grandfather was more, he was more chill and more kind of like even keel, But again, I was surrounded by two very strong women. So it was kind of like, you weren't going to get out of line, but so much. Not if you actually really wanted to live to tell it. Like, I mean, it was like, really wanted to live to tell it. Like, you just weren't going to do that. Now with Florence Reynolds, that just wasn't
going
to happen. You had to get up really early to pull one over on her because, remember, she is used to it. She's there in the inner city.
That's funny.
She's every single day. She had, Junior One, which at that time was one of the worst, schools, okay? Exactly. You know, it was so. So she was right in there, you know, kind of with them, you know.
It's a lower level correctional facility, has it?
That. Yep. Mm-hmm.
You see it before that.
Yeah.
But a lot of times, that's unfortunately, that is what's missing in today's day and age.
Yeah.
Proper foundation and the consequences and the repercussions that our parents building us that
Gen we.
There was a line not to cross. Now, I'm not saying we didn't tow it.
Yeah, you really
we
did.
We towed it the hell out of it. But
really
it,
knew.
And the line that you were afraid to cross because if you did, you knew what was happening when you got home.
That's right.
Watching it, you know, in the words, you know.
Yeah, the whole neighborhood ready to, like, you know, whoopee. But they were like, everybody was ready. Everybody was ready.
Okay. You know, and I remember seeing his special and hearing that. And then as an adult, realizing, okay, all right. Yeah, the neighborhood that you grew. I mean, my grandmother was a perpetual, you know, window watcher. Like, she would sit at the windows, at her window, and you could not tell from the outside if she was actually looking at you. And then all of a sudden, somebody would do something, and she would just, I see you. You know, it almost scared the Jesus out of you because you just come out with, I see you, and you don't even see her face out through the screen window until this last minute. And then she said, and then you kind of do one of these, but it's too late. And
see,
it's
that, like, you're like, how did you see me?
I got you. I saw you. It's almost like, were you actually, it's almost like, were you praying for somebody to do something?
It's too late. You got caught.
Were you actually like praying for somebody to do something? Are you happy that this happened?
I'm gonna tell your mom.
Your expression is giving joy.
Right. Yeah, that was just the first level. That was the first level.
That's right.
You got past her, and you had the one down the street that was going to get you as well. So it was,
but we have two more questions to ask you, and then we have to, you know, wrap it up. But I just wanted to find out from you.
Yes.
So, like, looking back now, do you feel that there were other officers that maybe struggled to come back into, I guess, if you will, a civilian, you know, life, or a lack of a better term. Excuse me, I just got to plug in my laptop here. I'm going to die on you. You know, yeah.
What's that like? Yeah, and I'm also curious, like, just to, as a piggyback on that, it's like, what do you do, like, the first week after retirement, right? Like when you don't have to be up, when you don't have to, what is the first day, the first week, the first month when you're just like, okay, like, I'm actually not just retired, but, like, retired from this high stressful job that I didn't even realize was, like, as stressful. Like, what is the first couple of days?
I can imagine.
And how do you transition to, like, civilian life?
S-L-E-E-P.
Yeah.
Sleep. That was the best thing that I could do. There was no clock to wake up to. You could just sleep as long as you wanted to until you got tired of it.
Let me ask, did you retire? Like, did you end on a Friday or was it like a Wednesday? And I guess I'm asking because it's like, does your brain, you know that you're actually retired, or does it just think it's the weekend?
No.
Right? Because it's like, it's Friday. Okay. Like, we're just going to go to sleep.
I would definitely pop up. Like, because your body was just so wired
for
that. But then you tell yourself, I don't have to go to sleep. So in that first week or two, it was, my body was like, you got to get up. You have to get up. And you would find yourself actually getting up out of bed, jumping, and you remind yourself, wait a minute, I don't have to go to work anymore. I'm okay. I'm fine. I'm straight. So it is a process to learn, to get used to. And then after that, I can tell you the stress and the anxiety that left, because I was going to the gym, but I also lost 13 pounds within like 6 months.
Wow.
And it was just, and I believe it was just like the stress and the anxiety that was causing
the inflammation, the cortisol,
Because I was able to relax and just breathe.
Yeah. But that,
it was a whole lot easier. But the I will tell you, the first legal thing I did was take a Gumby with my wife's. I wasn't able to do that for 29 years, and she would always enjoy herself, and I couldn't. So, I mean,
yeah.
That life. So, I mean, you know, I enjoy it a little bit. It's just something you can't do. You want.
Correct.
Yeah. You know, so we enjoyed ourselves for that. But, you know, that's just the little things. And just being able to not enjoy life, but be present in the moment.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
when I retired, I realized, like, you take a yeah. look back and you realize all the moments that you missed, the family activities, the funeral of family members, of friends that you missed. And you, within the day-to-day rigmarole, you don't really have a chance to reflect on that. And that took a somber time for me. It took me a couple of days to say, you yeah. know, I've missed some of my friends' mother's funerals that have passed, grandmother.
Yeah.
And you say, was it worth it?
Was it worth it? No.
You want to be able to say your goodbyes, but you weren't able to because of the work that you were putting in, the time that you had to be there.
Yeah.
And just, you know, that's an aspect that no one will tell you of or tell you about until you're retired and you take a look back and you say, man, I really did miss a lot.
Yeah. There's grief in that, I have to imagine, right?
Cause, yeah, absolutely.
Cause it's just like that's a process where you realize, like, man, what did I really miss out and was it worth it? But I ask you back then, it was like, of course it was worth it. Like, you're giving your kids the better
you're in that mindset, you're in that schedule, and you're all that motor work that keep you going one thing, and then you take a look back and you're like, wait, who passed away?
Right.
When did this happen?
Right.
And it's
crazy.
It is a somber moment to think back and to reflect on it. And then you're like, why? And you ask yourself that question and you have no answer is the scary part of it.
That's for sure. It's like the philosophical existential crisis of like, what was it worth it? Like, it's hard to look back. It's hard. Hindsight is hard. It's
right.
It's hard to look back.
It's always 2020, right? They tell you that, but you don't realize it until you have to look over your shoulder and see the things that you missed as opposed to, you know, your decisions you made in that present moment.
Well, but here's the hoping. I'm like, I always try to look at it from the, especially you're like, you're very young, that you say to yourself, you know, you're in a position where you're not on your deathbed, right? You're not like in your 80s where you can't travel with your, you can't, you know, like you have the, hopefully you have the perspective of like, I have the next 20 years, not to make up for that, but it's like, I still get to have life. I still get to like walk my daughters down the aisle, if that's the thing. I get to walk, you know, like I get to see, knock on with, see my grandkids. Like there's just this level of, you hope that you try to make the next 20 years, the next 30 years.
Absolutely.
Better than the last 20 years.
Yes. Because we all have, you know, more time behind us than we have in front of us. So you want to make the most of it. You
getting ready to close, but before we do, like, I have one last question.
If there's one thing
that you would think the public, you know, would better understand about the correctional officers and that whole, the mental toll that it takes, what would that be? If you could describe one thing that the public just doesn't know, you know what I mean? That sharing that would kind of shed some light on what you guys go through on a day-to-day basis and how that kind of does change. I remember I knew someone many, many years ago whose personality was, you know, one way. And then it seemed like immediately after getting into that arena, it seemed like, you know, it was almost kind of like a off switch or whatever, you know, just kind of like checked out to a certain extent, you know, not completely, but just was a different person than when initially starting. So I can see how it does change people. But, you know, what's one thing, you know, that the public, you would want the public to know that you guys go through in terms of even perhaps if they're married, being more patient with your spouse or whatever it is. What's one thing that you would say that you would want the public to know? Okay.
I'll sum it up like this. Everything that you see on TV isn't necessarily what goes on in a jail. And I will say that a lot of folks tend to think that correction officers don't do anything. And I will leave you with this. Correction officers don't get paid for what they do. They get paid for what they may have to do.
Mm.
So if I can relax on a unit for 7 hours, but that 1 hour in between, all hell breaks loose. Can you deal with that as a public? Can you deal with pieces thrown on you? Can you deal with urine thrown on you? Can you deal with somebody spitting on you? That's what correction officers get paid to do. So when you see correction officers, you think they're just getting paid to sit in a chair and laugh or watch inmates and do nothing. That's absolutely not true. That's not the story. And that is just what you see as the front side. Not anyone that has worked corrections has to deal with a mental, a lapse in just everything that they've grown up to know. When you walk through that door, the mental toll that it takes on you is unbelievable. And you don't realize that until you're done. If, in fact, you are able to finish.
Because can I ask, just as a little bit as a piggyback, for someone who might want to get into the profession, what would you say to them, how to prepare? What are the things that you would want? What would you have wanted to know or prepare for, entering back? What would you have wanted somebody to tell you or prepared you for this profession?
Nothing can prepare you for this profession. Everything that you learn or are going to learn is going to be from experience. Treat everyone with respect. That way you can try and earn your respect back. It's not given. Everything that you get in that jail is going to have to be earned. Whether you have to do it with your with vocal skills or with physical force. Eventually you will learn your way. Unfortunately, it's going to have to be one of the two. So you have to learn that delicate balance between the two.
I appreciate this and appreciate you being a guest on our, first episode, Eddie. I really appreciate it. And thank you, Eddie, for being our resident, therapist on here. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, so this was good. So as we conclude, guys, watching, thank you for watching this first episode. Mm-hmm. We will be on next Monday evening at 6 p.m. live on YouTube, and then later be uploaded to Spotify, Facebook, and it'll be out there, Instagram and all the others, but it'll be FaceTime.
First time. That's right.
Here live, YouTube. Okay. And next time what we're doing is we are delving into looking at alcoholism. Our guest, struggled with it and has come out on the other side. And we want to kind of really get into that and talk about, what that was like for him, kind of what was his turning point and where he is now, because he really has, kind of turned the corner, has been, dealing with his sobriety for quite a number of years. So we want to talk about that and explore that. So once again, thank you for joining us here with Pull Up and Pour. We've gone over a little bit, but hey, that's what happens when you have good conversation. See you next time at 6. And as we say here, we sip it, we share it, we drink it.
Salute.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Enjoy, everybody. Be safe. Be healthy.
Okay, so
bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. We are not recording, I don't think. Hold on. Yeah, I don't think that. It says live, but I don't think we are actually recording because I stopped it. Yeah, I don't think we are live. So what I want to do is close out and then, I think she may have clicked off already. Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Oh. Leave studio.